And on our panel today, we have the three main players of this event from 1994 in attendance, and we also have a special guest with us from NC State University. But to intro the three panelists today, I've got David McConville, who is an expert in the world of spherical display content development as a co-founder of the Illuminati. Mr. Conville is joined the St. Paul Riverfront. He has joined the St. Paul Riverfront Project to consult on exhibition media design and the Digital Dome Theater. The project is directed and consulted on numerous international museums, theaters, and galleries. Prior to forming the Illuminati, he served as Director of Digital Media Solutions for Illumins Corporation, where he designed and productized numerous content creation tools and techniques. He's written numerous articles in the field of digital dome content development and has worked internationally with film, video, animation, real-time 3D, and audio production companies. So welcome, David.
Thanks.
Then we have probably the father of computer, I guess, knowledge here in Chapel Hill. That's what I want to say. This is our name.
Don't tell Fred Brooks.
This is How about that? So on the air we have, how about that? The godfather of computer technology at Chapel Hill. That is Paul Jones. He's director of iBiblio, the site formerly known as MetaLab and SunSite, which is a large contributor-run digital library. Paul teaches on the faculties of the School of Journalism and Mass Communication here in Chapel Hill, and also the School of Information and Library Science. Jones has an additional ongoing research interest in open source and sharing communities and information policy issues, as well as being an actively published poet. Paul's the editor of the Internet Poetry Archives, published with the UNC Press, a little known fact there for you. He's also on the Board of Trustees at the Chapel Hill Public Library. All right.
That's right.
So welcome, Paul Jones. And then without further ado, we also have Mike Schaffner, working part-time for the Office of Information and Technology as a part-time systems administrator and also as an XYZ DJ in 1993. He basically was the guy that was the cheerleader and catalyst, in his words, behind this event and really getting this technology to get going in 1994. Mike is now a technologist with UNC Chapel Hill. And Mike, thank you for coming here on the panel. All right, so my first question is really to David McConville. David, can you kind of just retrace the steps of the history of what went on in 94?
Sure, but I would encourage Paul or Mike to jump in because my memory is kind of foggy. Let's see, I don't know, Paul was good enough to hire a bunch of folks to come in and do things that he couldn't define and nobody else could define because he had this web server set up, SunSite, at the time. When was that first set up as a web server?
92 is a web server.
92, and Tim Berners-Lee came over?
We did a lot of things before then. Right. The short part of that is we were communicating with the guy in Switzerland we were doing some searching and retrieval stuff, and he said he was coming over to give a paper at Hypertext 91 in San Antonio, but as it turned out, they didn't accept his paper. He had to do a poster session because his project, the World Wide Web, was too simple for computer scientists to appreciate, and it didn't have persistent connections and a bunch of other stuff that you had to have if you were going to have a hypertext environment. So he had to actually pay for part of his trip himself because the Swiss research group he was with told him they'd only pay full amount if he got his paper accepted. So then he came by and we had a couple of beers, and I had a NAC so I could run the only web browser that existed at that time, and we set up a web server with one page that said hello, and I could connect to all six worldwide websites. All of them had to do with high energy physics. I didn't know anything about that. Anyway, keep going.
Yeah, and so I guess that was the point at which you realized, hey, let's put some weird stuff on here? Or like, how did that work? I mean, I
blame you for anything weird. Everything we did, of course, was of the highest scholarship.
Yeah, right.
It really was.
Which, I mean, actually, I came to Chapel Hill in 94, and I'd gotten a bunch of information off of Launchpad, which was the BBS that they were running that was
we did that too.
Pre-SunSite. And I was getting all this information. I was really into radio, and I was like getting stuff from Free Radio Berkeley to build like amplifiers, and I was just like radio a lot. And I came and met Paul, and we kind of hit it off. And I told him I like doing audio video stuff, so he said, "Okay, well, you're hired." I don't know. You have a title? I don't know. Multimedia.
I think something. We called you multimedia something. The last one was multimedia Shogun, but
okay.
The new guy's got it. It's been like too shy to use that.
Yeah.
Most to use something like guru or expert or something.
Yeah. Jedi. So basically, Paul just gave us free rein. I mean, he said, go out and figure out what this stuff's good for. Because at the time, it was pretty wide open, Wild West-like, I guess. It was, you know, lots and lots of text, and then this.
We were doing some multimedia, but not in any streaming.
But, like, the image stuff had just really happened with Mark Andreessen. He, like, proposed doing images, and everybody thought that was going to be useless, I think.
It was going to kill bandwidth.
Everybody was all upset.
I think one of the things that you have to understand is all along people were concerned that we were going to destroy the internet. In fact, Brad Templeton, who's now the president of the EFF, Electronic Frontier Foundation, wrote me a scalding letter about how if we put this station on, anybody could put their own radio station on and then the internet would completely melt down. Any idiot could become a broadcaster. Of course, that was our point. That's why I hired
David.
We
were hoping for.
Now, David, did you more have a love for radio, just independent radio or music? What was kind of what drove you to really?
Well, I've never really been anywhere with a good radio station. And I mean, I loved music. I've been a collector all my life. And when I found XYC, it just blew me away. I was like, wow, you know, you kid. Balinese Monkey Chants and, you know, Aphex Twin in the same 10 minutes, and it was really enlivening. And honestly, the whole time I was in Chapel Hill, it was one of the few things that kept me sane, I think. And so when we started talking about ways of exploring, we did a few things prior to XYC,
yeah,
where we were experimenting with MP2, which, of course, was pre-MP3, and we were doing some audio encoding. And we worked with, Mammoth Records was, I forgot the order of everything.
We did some stuff with Mammoth, and we did some stuff with the Internet Underground Music Archive, which was neither underground or very good music.
Yeah.
And they didn't archive anything either.
Yeah.
So it was on the Internet.
But we were experimenting a lot with encoding techniques, and we were interested. We worked with some local indie music scene to put their music online. We contacted this group, Negative Land, who had been sued by YouTube for various and sundry copyright infringements, and we said, hey, can we put your stuff online? Because all their CDs had been destroyed of this particular record. And I mean, basically, Paul was like, well, go ahead and do it, and we'll defend it later. Is that okay to say?
Well, we were, of course, constantly in touch with the cutting edge of legal advice on this, and we understood that we were an experimental group, and so that we had a lot of areas to move in there, as long as we weren't in, and you have to remember, this is pre-commercial internet, really.
Yeah, there was
the edge of it. So we're really a research group.
Now, the guy that was part of that influence is Mike Schaffner.
Absolutely.
But Mike, I kind of found this from Tim Ross's article in Audible. It's the WXYC newsletter. Pick it up around town. But Mike, you sent an email that says, "Do this first." This is the XYC management. Do this work first, if only for a short time. First, us, not NPR. Why did you take it so hard to XYC management to get this on? What was kind of really the impetus to say, let's be the first?
I think once the idea kind of appeared, it just became a race against death, time, whatever,
okay,
to get it done first, you know, and to, just because, you know, that's just what seems to be valuable in a lot of cases, and you know, it was important ground to break. And at the time, I remember thinking, you know, it'd be such a great thing to have for sort of this ragtag band of underfunded, let's put it that way, and in some cases freak-like people to, you know, just to see that even in the age of, you know, engineered, you know, people engineer their kids by teaching them Suzuki method at, you know, 1.5, you know, the age of that, the age of heavy corporate influence, and you know, when the big guys usually win, it'd just be nice for the little guys to actually come out ahead.
And
really,
okay.
Yeah, and it, you know, it wasn't quite that it wasn't quite that cut and dry at the time, but the idea was just let's try to get this thing out there and just show this initiative and
to be supportive of the people at XYZ. I mean, they actually had something at risk, like their license could have been revoked or their BMI contract, ASCAP BMI contracts have been crammed. Our risk was pretty low. I mean, for what we were doing, we weren't doing things that were patently illegal as were already being done on the M-Bone, which is people playing their music collections on the M-Bone on channels and then people would shut them down.
The M-Bone was the multimedia backbone at the time because nobody was doing audio video broadcasting directly. And so it was kind of like what the Internet 2 sort of is now, in that it would be to universities. And we did a lot of experiments with that. And Sunsite was actually, before I got there, you were doing
We did a lot of Internet stuff.
And the radio stuff with Malamud.
Yeah, we did some stuff with Internet Talk Radio with Carl Malamud.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, there was broadcasts happening. It was just, this was basically the idea to rebroadcast 24/7 a station. And at the time, I was in graduate school in the journalism school, and I was writing... they're doing research and writing a paper for media law classes on what the implications of this stuff would be. So we looked a lot into, like, what are the precedents here? I mean, I think the closest thing was, you know, music on hold when you call somebody and they're playing the radio station over it or whatever. But
Carrier current stations. That was really good because all university student stations, all of their, everybody has a carrier current license, right? So you can reach the dorms even if it can't, like, beam through however many bricks are in there.
Okay.
And so that means you can put a radio signal on a wire, and you have an exemption. But they never said it. Nobody assumed, because carrier current doesn't, like, go forever. We just said, oh, well, the Internet is a lot like carrier current. It's just longer.
And we spent a lot of time explaining to lawyers the difference between streaming and downloading. I mean, because at the time, there was, like, that was a pretty unknown distinction.
Did they get it?
No.
No,
these were smart people.
people who were even involved in the ITF, Internet Engineering Task Force, and other people were really not clued. I mean, they kept saying, you know, that we would shut down the Internet, that we would be breaking laws, that we could never get a permission. And really, we sort of idled for several months.
And actually, I believe that you had kind of thought there was a risk in at least the first 24 hours. You thought it may take up... shut down the UNC network, right?
Well, we actually did tell Jim Gogan that we were doing it, which we did debate the wisdom of that. But then we wondered how many people really wanted to listen to XYZ. And then we felt a lot better.
Ouch.
All right, well, hold on. Now,
it got better.
Now, here, the story that I would like to hear is from David and Mike. And tell me about the radio that you wired down at the bottom of Phillips Hall. Because I think that is... to really first broadcast that signal on, if you could tell the listeners.
That radio came from my sister, and she's 12 years younger than I am, and it came from a yard sale or something, and it was just a $2 radio, and we just used it to pick the station up, and we wired it into your machine, and you had that Mac, and didn't we had to buy the encoding card ourselves. Basically, we were doing everything we could other than threatening. I don't know, we were threatening people, too.
No, I think you did.
Yeah.
Just to get this thing rolling. I mean, it's like, you see this vision.
Kind of
and we were a little, yeah. You see this vision, and then you just really want to pounce on it just to get it to happen. And, you know, luckily, Paul and those guys, I mean, just independent of David and myself were, you know, obviously backing it or wouldn't have happened. And on the station side, you know, we had Jeff Robbins and Jay Huber and Bill and Pat Anders and other people, you know, looking at
a very knowledgeable lawyer.
Oh, geez. The whole station was just full of lawyers at the time. I mean, it was, which really worked out well because they spent a lot of time, you know. I mean, everything now has got to go through a lawyer just for your sort of risk management side. And that was true of this. And,
I think one reason it took so long is there were so many lawyers on the XYZ.
Yeah,
there was just like some fool that we could lie to. I mean, pardon me, somebody we could have convinced more gingerly.
There's some pretty heated exchanges on the list.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I mean, the other thing is, so what the technology we were using was like the audio component of CUCME.
Right, because it was the cheesiest way we could figure to do it.
Yeah, I mean, we were...
But also what we did is look at how much bandwidth that took, which was minuscule.
Yeah, yeah. And we were total hacks, so we didn't have any desire to actually write something from scratch. So the Sunsite was acting as a reflector, what they called at the time, where people would log in from all over the world, basically see all these other video streams from other places. So, like, we'd come in every morning and log on, and there'd be some guy from Japan or... from Ireland or whatever. And so that's where we kind of got the idea. It's like, let's just use this audio component. So there's already kind of some really interesting stuff happening.
Yeah, there was a lot of point-to-point conference. It was about point-to-point video conferencing. So you could have multiple points up.
That was your idea,
but
too.
But the smart thing was to reduce the bandwidth, use this low bandwidth application. It was highly distributed. Yeah. It was easy to get. Anybody could pick it up. What separated us, I think, from the guys at Georgia Tech, who they were writing their own audio conferencing system from the ground up. And we basically looked at the Lego box and said, oh, here's this Lego piece and here's this Lego piece. And they said this is a wheel, but I really think it'd be a great eye. And this yellow block over there, they'd make a great nose. And before we know it, we had our own robot, you know. So whereas these guys were milling every piece. So we were able to move pretty quickly and understand how those pieces worked without having to go through a testing sequence.
Now, what made you, Paul, I'm going to ask this question to you. What made you trust these so-called hacks?
Well,
I want to hear this one.
I'm not easily amused, and I need some very amusing people around to keep me happy. And certainly David and Michael are highly amusing, particularly when they're very motivated. They were really motivated then. That was great. And I mean, you know, that's why you're at a research university anyway, is to get creative people in and to give them a chance to be creative and to give them a chance to surprise you and amaze you and to ask you tough questions that you hope you can say yes to all the time. And that's the whole point. So if we're not doing that, I mean, we might as well, you know, go make
Well, we got a good audience out here. Speaking of creative people, we have a very creative crowd. And I'm going to open this up to a line of questions if you guys have some in the crowd. Bill, hey, you can ask these three about what went on in 1994, what your views are, at least as far as online streaming now. And then I'm going to have John Streck come up and at least talk to us about Internet 2 technology, which we're going to be streaming online, which we're the second audio stream on Internet 2, but we'll be talking with John after that. So, any questions that you guys may have?
CB.
What's the story behind the Swedish scientists?
Okay.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Question is from the crowd: is what's the story behind the Swedish scientist?
You mean the Swiss station or the Swedish?
The Swedish.
Oh, man, might not know this one. You guys have to catch me.
No,
it's Swiss.
It's Swiss.
Okay.
You're talking about DRS3.
Yeah.
The question is what is behind the Swiss? What is the story behind the Swiss scientist?
Well, we did do a lot of PR. I mean, within our limited capabilities, and even the University News Bureau somehow decided that this was a good story, and they put it out. And there was a lot of the IETF was pretty revved up internationally about how we were destroying the internet. And I recommend two parts of evidence of this. One is Brad Templeton's letter, which to me, which I have contributed to the public domain. I know he's at the EFF and feels that, like, that's probably a fine thing to do. So it's on the XYZ website. And I talked to him and he said, I'm sure it was true at the time. That's all he said. He wouldn't talk to me anymore. But also scientists all over the world, computer scientists that thought that actually people using the internet in this way was like a terrible thing, because they were going through a big crisis, frankly. It had been their private experimental toy, and it had moved. Al Gore had the vision to take it out of the Defense Department, to move it into the National Science Foundation, and then make it commercial, and that way invent the internet. And I believe this, honestly, you can laugh. So these scientists were all freaking out, frankly, about it. It was already happened by that point. You know, AOL people were already on the internet. All kinds of terrible things had happened. We were all going to hell. And we were just one more, you know, we were like gay marriage or something. We were one of the worst things happening. You know, family wasn't going to exist anymore. And when you check in, when you hear these guys on DRS3 in Switzerland, they're saying that somebody got the tape of it. I don't know where. But these guys are listening, and they're saying, oh, there's the sound of the future of the internet radio. And this guy's like goes on this rant about how terrible we are. And then you hear what they're listening to, and it's, well, you'll hear on the CD, no one was in any danger.
The amount of breakup was hilarious, you know, but, you know, they were in Switzerland, and they were hearing Johnny Cash, may he rest in peace, and they, whatever else was playing at XYZ at the time, which was a kind of eclectic mix. I think there are two or three different things that pop up during the interview. It's a hilarious interview that I still find amazing and amusing now, which is on the Bandwidth CD, which you can download.
An excerpt of it.
Not the whole one.
The whole version's on the website.
Okay. Right.
The full version is on the Bandwidth. No, it's on the website. Right. The short version's on the Bandwidth.
On the CD.
Oh, because of Cash.
All right. Any other questions from the crowd? Okay.
Actually, I have a question. How long did it take from the inception of the idea to where you actually went online? What was the time frame?
You mean until we actually told people we were online, or until we actually were online?
The initial idea.
All right, the question is, how long did it take for the inception of the idea to implementing the idea online?
It was a few months. Because we kind of thought about it, like, I guess, late summer.
Yeah, I think we could have done it in a couple of weeks, except...
We had this legal stuff
going on, and we did have actual bandwidth considerations, so that we actually tested on campus with, you know, everybody in the office listened in to whatever audio we put on. I don't know if it was even the station.
Yeah, and we were experimenting.
Just see if we'd melt anything down, or see if Jim Gogan would call us up.
We were doing a lot of stuff.
He was sort of our bandwidth regulator. If we use enough bandwidth that he'll call us, then we'll probably.
Because we were doing a lot with CUCME.
Yeah, I mean, that already.
Was, yeah, like, I, because all these weird things kept happening that seemed really big at the time, like during the coup in Moscow, and Jonathan had the only IRC line.
Right,
to the outside. He was, like, typing to somebody inside of the Kremlin or something, and then, like, during an IRA ceasefire, some guy It was a complete media blackout, and some guy in Northern Ireland logged onto our reflector and pointed the camera out the window for me. Mm-hmm. So I was probably like the only person in the world seeing this thing. So, you know, at the time, it was like, wow, this stuff seems important, you know. And so, like, it was kind of in this weird mixture where you'd come in and you never really knew what was going to happen that day.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
That's still true. You see, you guys have just aged out.
Can you tell the listeners a little bit about CUCME, just to kind of give a little short briefing?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically, I mean, everybody has it now in whatever weird form. It's just audio-video teleconferencing software where you go point-to-point and you connect with somebody. And what's Apple's thing called? iChat.
iChat's sort of the same way. It uses a little different protocol.
Yeah.
It's from Cornell University. We should say that's where the CU came from, so they get the attention that they deserve. It's a low black-and-white bandwidth video that has two great accidental special effects. One is Picasso vision. It paints the picture you're looking at in little squares, like little cubes. And so if somebody moves, it only tries to reprint the parts that have changed. So sometimes your eyes and nose will be over here, and your body will be over here. So you get the great Picasso effect. And the other is Jell-O vision. And Jell-O vision's where you correct it for the Picasso vision, and instead you get everybody's kind of moving like they're walking in Jell-O. I liked those moments, actually, and missed them, you know, sort of like for early film where everybody, you know, accidental effects of film become good effects.
Clean,
yeah, so, yeah, who needs it? I don't want to see these people.
But
that
then
well.
We were using Maven. Was Maven separate from CUCME? I don't remember. It seems like they incorporated or something.
They incorporated. Maven was the audio part. Original CUCME had no audio component.
Okay. Any other questions? All right.
So, next, more technologically advanced.
Oh, geez.
Has it been 5 years? The question is, how long did the original programming last, or at least the original tool to broadcast that signal last?
It lasted years. Let's say, Paul, do you know, 5 or 6 years? I mean, it was a long time.
Well, we should say, in the middle of this, we were also experimenting with MPEG audio, too, with a company called Zing that's been since bought by Real Audio, Real Networks. And they were doing MPEG-2 encoding. And we decided this was really cool, and that, you know, the future would be in this direction, and it would be so much cleaner, and it would be so much smarter. And we were about probably 20% right. because their clients were so bad and nobody would ever use them, and then they would break and we quit using them, and we'd still broadcast with Zing anyway.
The client software, you mean?
The client software, yes.
Not the bad people.
Not the people who lost over. Well, they may have done that too after the software didn't work. But, I mean, it was very experimental, and it would, I mean, the encoding part was really good. The picking up and receiving part, they were a little slack on that.
Now, you weren't using the same radio, the same $2 radio.
What's good? Like,
I think we upgraded to one of Doug Matthews' receivers.
I had a little Sony that we were using for a while.
We used somebody's amp and preamp. I still have it.
Did you have a Sony Walkman that was like this big?
Yeah we used a Walkman at one point.
That was mine. Because I remember bringing that in. Did your sister's want it?
Okay. I got mine. Anyway, my sister got her radio back.
Yeah, I think we replaced it with like a little $5 Sony.
Yeah. You know, I mean, all you want to do is get the signal in. I'd have to say that besides Michael's enthusiasm for WXYC, one of the reasons we picked WXYC, say, over WUNC or WCP, a classical station, is that when you had a lot of breakup and interference and stuff, it really didn't matter. WXYC music all that much.
Oh, and we had to deal with this the whole
That's
time.
That's an elliptical
right. Shut up, Paul.
An elliptical
you
slur.
The technology label is now out the door.
Yeah.
Right. The any other questions?
Format was
around the world.
It would have been the Yanni station for up to Paul. So
it would have been all Van Morrison, but that's probably right.
Question from PJ.
Was there any legal backlash after you did start broadcasting on, and how have laws changed based on
The laws have changed a lot.
Let's throw that question out to the listeners. Yeah, I want to make sure this mic's on here. Was there any legal backlash from when you guys turned that switch on?
And how have the laws changed since then?
How have the laws changed since then?
As far as I know, there wasn't really much, and it was sort of, you know, the shot heard around the world kind of thing, and then nothing happened on the legal front for a while. But things, you know, I guess the legal landscape has changed quite a bit, and, you know, kind of let you guys...
Well, I've got the paper that I was working on at the time on the XYC site that basically looked at radio history. And I was pretty cynical about how the future was going to work out. I figured somebody would end up trying to control it somehow. But I think, like, the conclusion that we arrived at the time legally was that the FCC wasn't really going to touch it, right? I mean, it was more about copyright than it was about bandwidth scarcity and frequency regulation. So, I mean, which ended up being the deal with internet radio anyway.
Right.
I mean, like, at the time we were like, well, it's probably all going to be under copyright, and it's all going to come down to the distinction between streaming and downloading. And then, you know, 5 years later, Napster comes along and... You kind of see all of that go crazy.
Okay.
And also there's the distinction between that you weren't sending out an original feed, but you were sending out a retransmission, which was covered under the copyright clause.
Right, exactly.
That's the key distinction, too.
All right, so maybe you want to repeat that key distinction again.
Oh, just that instead of sending out an original, like, originated radio station, it was legally different. Since we were retransmitting an existing signal from an off-air radio station, which is why we kept going back to kind of the case law we could find.
We had a lot of, some of the licenses that protect and make sure that the creators, that is, the people covered at that time by ASCAP and BMI, were recouping what they were allowed to recoup under law had to do with the station was already paying.
Okay. All right.
So it just became a question of how many additional listeners and that sort of thing, because they meter it. I mean, they charge you based on
there has been a whole new bunch of copyright the copyright arbitration panel decided something 2.5 years ago now that's finally beginning to kick in that says, you know, you need to say how many listeners for how much and all this kind of thing. Even that lagged. About how behavior really works, and that'll probably be renegotiated. And student stations get a break, and not-for-profit stations get a break, and NPR stations and WCPE, which is not the only non-NPR station, have a separate negotiation for what they pay.
Any other questions? Because if not...
I wanted to say something really quick, just about kind of an ironic situation I'm in, because over the past 4 years I've been working on getting a low-power FM station going. Because they outlawed, like, you know, 100 watt and under stations 20 years ago, 25 years ago, and they recently, the FCC recently has allowed low power licenses for 10 and 100 watt stations. But I've been working for a few years on getting that in our town. I live in Asheville, North Carolina. And when we ended up getting it, the FCC, for some reason, gave us the same frequency as a shock jock station from Nashville, like a clear channel shock jock station. So, like, we're in this really strange situation where they give us an antenna way outside of town, and you can't really hear our station in the middle of downtown. And so it turns out that the majority of people in town, or a lot of the folks that I've talked to that are listening to the station, are actually listening to it on the internet feed. So it's kind of like this righteous justification where we finally got some off-air stuff, but the internet feed thing has come in really handy.
Okay. Now, because I was about to lead into that, but first I want to talk to John Streck here, who I want to introduce. He's the Director of Networking and Research Development for NC State Networks. And he's also director for North Carolina ITEC, which is the Internet 2 Technical Evaluation Center, aka the Centaur Lab.
Right.
But more importantly, your daughter also went to UNC Chapel Hill as a Moorhead Scholar, and she played on the field hockey team. I'm more impressed with that.
Girls always impress
you. But you have a deep knowledge for Internet 2, and we're the second radio station, eerily enough. This year, we were the second radio station to launch onto Internet 2, and the reason why I'd like you to at least address this topic is, what are the advantages of Internet 2 technology? What's the big deal about us being streamed online via Internet 2?
Well, let me go back to what Paul, as he's getting some coffee, as he pointed out, is that even though Gore takes a bad hit for something he spoke incorrectly of, he was one of the initial forces on the internet of actually getting it through Congress. And he was with, I think it was Senator Markey, if I'm correct, from Massachusetts, who formed in about 80 years ago the thrust to take and once again put internet technology back in the university and research groups. So that's where he with the senator, went back and said, all right, maybe we need to rebirth this and start again of what was a good tool of getting innovation and new ideas, almost like what you did with the radio station, is that it had become commercialized, and it wasn't an internet, it was internets.
Okay.
When it was commercialized, I'm sorry?
That's what must be what George Bush was talking about.
Well, if you're trying to add logic about dumb luck, he probably made it right once out of 50 times that he said something, but we won't get into politics. And I didn't say that. But what happened was is that as it commercialized, all the different carriers and what they call the ISPs, the suppliers of the internet technologies, had their own networks, and they would, in different places around the country, around the world, have sites of co-location, so they'd be able to pass the information, the internet, the IP technology to each other, and eventually make its way. So at that time, with it being commercialized, there was less and less of push for high-end applications in the internet. So Internet 2 was not formed to make another big pipe, another network. It was formed to foster high-end applications. As Paul said, and other, one of the big thrusts around the high bandwidth are higher energy physics, and so that a lot of that's done in, there's the collider in CERN in Switzerland. You have places around the Argonne Labs in Lawrence Livermore where they're doing research, and you also have one thing that even Chapel Hill, who's one of the prime things that's quoted on, we have these observatories like down in Chile. And where you can have this, because you want to have an observatory in a place where there's very little smog or there's very little interference with your optical viewing of the skies, or interference, radio interference. So you put them in these remote sites. Well, in the remote sites, a lot of people don't want to go to the remote sites. So it's an ideal application of actually taking something that's a high bandwidth, putting something remote, but letting everybody else get at it.
Okay, now for neophytes, high-end applications would be?
Well, high-end applications now, it's all relative, but as the technology changes, high-end applications would be something that'd be pushing hundreds of megabits or gigabits worth of data.
Okay.
And that's a high-end application. In difference to something that has started recently that your CTO, CIO Dan Reed is, which is Renaissance Computing, has started recently here at Chapel Hill in the Triangle, which was doing high-end calculations and computations versus actually pushing high amounts of data on a network. So
right now it's sort of, I guess, what is it, Marshall McLuhan did the medium as massage a long time ago?
Yeah.
And it's sort of, the medium is now the computer. The network is the computer.
Okay.
And so everything, there's compute sites all around, and the network now is just like the backplane in your PC. And so as those connectivity becomes larger and larger, then everything looks local to you. And but the thrust around Internet 2 was to really drive the high-end applications. And now it's been, since it was 96, so it's 8 years later. In the last 2 years, we're starting to see the applications come because they had to put all the bricks and mortar, as they say, all the network connections, all the other things around to the different research entities. And now that it's on there, people are starting to develop these high-end applications.
Now, I'm an XYC listener.
Mm-hmm.
What is the advantage for me to be able to have that on Internet?
Ah. The reason that Internet 2 is advantageous to you is probably for distribution around the U.S. and probably around the world. And I'll give you an example. Is that if I had to talk to you and then I had to relay it through everybody in the audience before the person at the end of the panel could hear it, mm-hmm. you'd have that long delay.
Okay.
What Internet 2 did is around the country short-circuited that. It had a couple key points of presence around the country, and then from there it would fin out to the regional areas. So what happened was, is now you connect it with IP or internet technology, it delivers messages as you did the streaming from the analog to the digital. It, what it did is it put everything into packets. So these little packets of information, as you accumulate them all, you convert it back to digital and you'd have your streaming of your information. Well, what happens when you put it into the internet technology is it was passed what they called hop by hop. I give it to you, and then you give it to Kansas City, and Kansas City give it to Orlando, Orlando go to Los Angeles, and maybe at some time, eventually, it get back to the person in Cairo.
Okay.
And it all depended on how everybody peered and connected together. By able to doing this over, by presenting the Internet 2, it was this high bandwidth highway that all the research and all the universities that attended to that could have near instantaneous connectivity around the country.
Okay.
So now you had a great delivery scheme, which is, as the rest of the panel here, when they early did XYZ, you worried about the bandwidth. Well, bandwidth was not the problem. The pipes were so large, it was like driving a Volkswagen on the Autobahn. I mean, no matter how fast you go, you wouldn't get into any trouble. And no matter how much bandwidth or radio there, or whatever you put on there, you wouldn't get in trouble because it was so large.
Okay.
And this has been up until recently, and what happens is the applications are lagging behind the technology, and the technology is now still farther ahead, where it's easier to make larger pipes, larger networks, so that the applications can't swamp out the network. The counter to that was the Napster and things like that, where people actually came up with a really cool way with this application, the peer-to-peer, or actually it was client-server to some degree, and then it was peer-to-peer as well, where they could actually multicast this information across, so they could now, instead of one, it looked like one source coming out there, it looked like N time sources coming out there.
Okay, now getting that feedback back, is that going to be as quick as, say, a telephone conversation, or is it going to still, you're going to have that lag, you're going to have some lag on Internet too?
Well, you're asking, it sounds like a simple question, but it's a complicated question.
Okay, well, I don't want to get too complicated.
No, all right, let me go through this. Is that when we were talking most of the time about streaming technology, mm-hmm. and streaming technology, what happens is if you're listening to something, it's the amount of delay before you get the first bit of information, and then, let's say, your record, you hear the record at the other end, you're recording.
Mm-hmm.
That's indifferent in didactic or where it's bidirectional. And bidirectional, then there is, like your telephone call, then you're depending upon a response before you know to speak the other way. And that's where delay hurts.
Okay.
But with streaming, it doesn't. It's like a pray and send, or you're just forwarding the information, it accumulates it, and you can play it back. So you can have tremendous amount of, you can have a full DVD movie if you know you're only going to listen to it after it's sent 2 hours later because it starts streaming it all in until it accumulates it, and then you can watch it. And that's the beauty, if you know what you're going to, your application is, then you can take into account the delay, because one of the things that's the greatest nemesis to any application on the internet is that it's very hard, they're still trying to do it, I don't know if anybody's actually done it, to violate the speed of light. And the speed of light really regulates how fast you get information from point A to point B. And when point B is Carrboro, no problem. When point B happens to be San Diego, then there is a problem.
Okay. How about sound? Am I going to get better sound?
Are you going to get, well, better sound, I guess, is, are you talking high fidelity, or number of channels or what?
Hey, I'm streaming online, and I want to know if I can be able to get very good sound out of my speakers on the internet too.
All right, then I would have to do that, and I'd fall back to the guys that are really the audiophiles here.
Okay.
Is that
they'll be 5-1 in real time? We promise.
And so what he's getting to is depending on how well you're encrypting or you're taking the data from the analog and you're putting into a digital stream. Depending on how much you sample it, how your sampling technology to retain the quality is, and at the other end, it's going to have that same quality.
Okay.
So it's the same thing if you were playing a DVD. If you can plant that full stream. Now, where it sort of got into the thing that Paul had said about early when they were doing See You, See Me and other things.
Breakup, right.
And what happened was is their encoding schemes were so primitive is that...
Yeah.
It couldn't pass so much but a small chunk of data. So even if they wanted to, the only way that they would have flooded the market, if there was 1,000 of these stations around and they were multicasting it, then they might have attacked the bandwidth in the system. But what happened is it was throttling from the sender, so it never got in to be a problem in the internet. And this is what the technologists and the lawyers have a problem with, is they're trying to comprehend by an old model that they know of, the radio or something else, and trying to transform that into the new model, and they're missing the point. They're missing a lot of places there.
All right, now I'm going to bring the Kingston Trio back in this whole conversation.
Right. I had a quick comment on, actually, when you plug in your...
More like the MC5.
So. All right, okay.
Yeah,
there you go. Treacherous 3, how about that? There you go.
When you plug in your DVD player to your, Dolby decoder or whatever, a lot of times you're using a little Toslink fiber optic cable. It's essentially the same kind of thing. I mean, it's just going from one point to the other along a fiber optic line, and it's just like transmitting a little tiny light along there. I mean, and when you start actually going over fiber using these techniques, it's whatever you're encoding and decoding. So it's right.
And one of the reasons that he's putting a very good point is that part of this, as technology went along, initially you had things like you see here, you had wires. And what occurred was is that the transmission media was very noisy. So if I was doing this and I had a normal microphone, if it wasn't shielded well and other things, then I would get a lot of noise coming into the signal. Well, what happened now is that, and this has been going on for almost 10 years, you've been digitizing it, so the only thing can happen, it's a 1 or a 0. And then it gets decoded and puts back into analog. So the problem that noise is, you may get noise, but it'll kill a couple ones in there and zeros, but the rest of it's untouched. And the whole length of that amount of noise you feel won't be detected, or very little, unless you have some type of data that's doing some scientific calculation. If it's music, you won't even know it.
I won't have that feedback or that little shrill noise, or at least a little static within internet too.
And sort of getting to the last part, which was that piece of fiber, by doing things over fiber optic, it's not sensitive to radio interference. So no matter how far I push it, now there is one thing that they found out in technology. It was in the CERN, also when they're doing some atomic research over there, doing the colliders, is they thought they were going to put fiber optics ring the whole CERN, and it was going to be impervious to anything. They forgot about one thing, another part of physics, and that was the radiation was actually changing the characteristics of the fiber optics. It wasn't, and all of a sudden their fibers were actually being disturbed and decayed and changed and transformed, and now they're losing signal and had to go back to copper and regular wires because it wasn't affected by radiation. So we learn as we go along, but to your category, whether I was here talking across the table here or here talking across the world, if I'm doing ones and zeros, it doesn't care.
I have a question now, thinking about IPv6. The place where IPv6 is most largely deployed is in Asia currently.
The two largest areas around the world that IPv, and everybody knows what, well, I'll go through IPv6, IPv4,
well,
but somebody might not know what that is.
Yeah, well, should we do that? Okay, go ahead.
All right, and I'll answer your question as well. IPv4 is IP protocol version 4, and that's been around now since Vint Cerf and the crew developed it.
Right.
It's almost 30 years or 30 years, very close, the anniversary for that. And then what happened was is that was the way that they were decided that the protocol on how you would send what's called layer 3 or the packets of information on the internet. Then the next version was IPv5. Nobody did anything with.
Mm-hmm.
Then they developed IPv6, which is version 6, which is the one that Paul you're talking about. And there's actually the IPv7 and IPv8, which isn't going to go anywhere. So the next IP version will be IPv9,
mm-hmm.
if they do one. And what was occurring is, so they have a new protocol for passing these packets. And really what the protocol is, it's just like if you're going to send a letter to someone across the country. It's how you make out the letter, how you put the packet, the information inside the letter, and how you seal it and you put it away. And that's what the internet is. The packet, the IPv packet, is like the letter, and the address is the to and from, and then the information inside is the payload. Same thing. So, Paul, your question was on V6. Could you bring it back again?
Well, IPv6 is most largely deployed in Asia currently because it's mandated by the telephone companies.
Yes.
I mean, they have to
do government. That. The government. It's really the government.
Right? Well, yeah. But basically, Domoco has IPv6 in its telephones.
Sure.
So the nice thing about putting XYC on IPv6 and Internet 2 is mm-hmm. you probably have better penetration of the Asian market.
Mm-hmm. Can we tour Japan?
I'd be fascinated by that story.
In fact, it strikes me that that the speed of Internet 2 is going to get it out further, and that IPv6 is already deployed there, so the IPv6 stream is going to get right to a cell phone in Tokyo probably easier than it's going to get, say, to Chapel Hill,
okay, well,
where we don't have
let me just answer Paul's. Is the two leading regions around the world, you're right, it's Asia, so it's Japan, Korea, and China. And the other leading area is Europe, predominantly the Nordic and UK and Nordic areas with a little bit of Spain. So those are the two leading areas. And the reason why they did that is because those regions besides the US were the ones that were starved in internet addressing. So they saw a need to go that way. And there was also another side reason was they figured that's the way that they would push out the US, which had been dominant in internet technology, to take a dominance there on the next generation. But you're right, and it's a natural, they do have it over there. How what has been thought of, but is actually not correct, is they are doing a lot of use of IPv6 in China and Japan, but the actual commercialized in business is actually used very little.
Okay. Now, because then we're gonna get into the next topic here.
Sure.
The reason why I'm kinda interrupting that is that the future of online programming, or at least radio broadcasting online, where do you guys see the future of online broadcasting?
We have three things going on this month that actually deal with this. For one is podcasting, in which Brian Russell here, who's in the audience, is doing. Then we're
it's amazing. I can't believe this.
We're doing podcasting with Roger McGuinn's Folk Den. Every song he puts out is out there. We're doing it with two or three other groups that are hosted on iBiblio. So
I've never heard of that. Is it just people putting MP3s on their site that
gets pushed
out to somebody?
Yeah, it's a little smarter than that.
We're talking about podcasts.
Let me
give you a quick one.
Folks, this is the brief intro to podcasting. Here you go.
Okay.
The
sequence is this. If you have a blog or if you have a website or if you have something that changes, rather than have people go there every time, they can listen to see if there's any change with an accuracy for RSS, really simple syndication
feeds. So it's RSS audio feeds?
It's RSS with audio enclosure.
Okay.
So you can listen, you can set up your aggregator, particularly iPod or X or Jagger are particularly good at this. And you can say, send me, whenever a show changes, whenever anything changes on this, let me know about it. Okay, so your aggregator says, okay, something new's happened. Instead of going and looking for it, you just have it listed there, and it gives you title, author, and all the metadata. The IDE3 tags, which are buried in MP3, if you produced it right, have the right stuff there. So you click on it. The aggregator will dump it, will either let you listen to it in a built-in listener, in iPod or X, dump it into iTunes, so you can play it there, and it shows up in iTunes perfectly well. So you can subscribe to a musician's website, for example, or to Brian's interview site, and you can get all the new interviews to come directly into iTunes. Then, of course, you can squirt it right into your iPod. So now you've got 80 gigabytes that you're carrying around, and you'd like for things to change in there periodically. You can subscribe to those on the internet, get the latest right there, and through a series of sort of silly steps right now, which will get better, but using the same Lego pieces but arranging them slightly different. Get MP3s into your iPod that are labeled. Not, you have to download them and then add little labels and do all this. It's already done for you. So that means that you'll be able to understand ownership, authorship, title, genre, all the things that you might want to do to organize the stuff in iTunes or on in your iPod. So that's one. So podcasting is one thing we're up to. The other thing that we're up to is a peer-to-peer application called BitTorrent, and we'll be using that. I just got a note from John Renning saying that BitTorrent is set up to be used for WXYC for distributing the CD, the bandwidth CD. Okay. And the cool part of that is instead of anybody who downloads also becomes an uploader. So BitTorrent tracks all the people who have downloaded, and you can be, you can not be an uploader if you want, you can be a leech. But if you're a leech, you pay leech tax, which means trying to download, you get less speed. But everybody who's downloaded something becomes an uploader so that the next person that comes gets more bits from more different places at once. So if 100 people download the CD, the first person gets one copy. It just takes however long it takes to download the CD. But the next, as more and more people download it, faster and faster your download time becomes. And your BitTorrent client just takes all those pieces that come in randomly and puts them all back together, and then you have an album. And
which is what Downhill Battle does, right?
Downhill Battle does it.
I mean, all this stuff is like so connected to copyright law too.
E-Tree does it.
And the way that people are like,
we also
that's
host,
what we're going to get into a little bit.
We also host E-Tree, which it's a tape tree thing of bands that allow taping off of their soundboards. And their whole thing is totally volunteer. Their website is a wiki. They have a rating site that lets you rate and whatever it is. If you do an MP3 or something that has loss, because they use lossless format, shorten and FLAC, to do this. And if it's been an MP3 at any generation, they kill it, because you can see that wherever they see a flat line, when they run it through, it's dead. Mm-hmm. And they evaluate this and they distribute.
So the bands actually want to have absolutely the highest quality? Or
yes.
The people running the...
Yes server? And yes. Okay. Because bands don't want to sound bad. I mean, interestingly enough, there are two reasons why bands deny access to knockoffs and pirates. One is they don't want crap out there that makes them sound bad. And the other is they want to get paid if it sounds good. amazingly enough, part two is less valuable, because you want your band to be known as sounding good so that people will come to the concert.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, in terms of, because I remember in a conversation with you that I have, Paul, a lot of your buddies are at Stanford right now at a podcasting conference.
It's part of BloggerCon, right?
Okay. Now, you used to mention to me it was clunky. The technology is clunky. How long are we away to get solid streams out of there? Or so, like, say, an XYC DJ could have a blog.
Well, basically, post that people who are providing have to understand how to provide, and the people who are receiving have to understand how to receive, and... I've seen two generations of iPod RX in 3 weeks already, and it was substantially improved, don't you think?
Okay. And that's why I have an expert here, and this guy is the savior of the day. He's the MVP of the day. Brian Russell.
Yeah.
Out of Carrboro.
I live in Chapel Hill, actually. Okay. So close to Carrboro, and my site's audioactivism.org, and hopefully these mics sound okay out there.
Very cool site, isn't
it? But I appreciate it. Basically, I just want to add to what Paul is saying, is that really podcasting is an automation of other technology that's already happening and putting it in an order to achieve something for more people out there. It's also doing something called time shifting, and that's what's great with iPods. Sort of like your VCR or your TiVo, it's saying, I want to listen to this content at a certain time when I have time, because having to tune in between 8 a.m. and 8:30 whatever is not convenient for me. And that's what's really different between streaming and podcasting or regular MP3s, and what is pushing this is that it's saying time is non-linear like our lives in some respect, not literally, and that I can get all this stuff to my iPod really quickly and easily, so more people are going to adopt to it. It's also a big difference between podcasting, let's say BitTorrent. There is a bit of information, understanding, and knowledge still going with BitTorrent technology, and that is keeping a lot of people out, because it's just too much crap to learn. Whereas with podcasting, it's a little bit simpler to receive information, and it's a tiny bit harder, but not really, to push the information.
But BitTorrent is built in to either Jagger or iPod or X, I forget which.
This is true. This is a good thing. I think it's iPod or X, and maybe the other big iPodder thing is just called iPodder, and it's built with Python, by the way, and it runs on just about any platform. But it's basically going out there and getting these BitTorrent files, which is a more efficient way to get it, and then saying, here you go, here's your file and that is enclosed in your BitTorrent file, like your MP3 or whatever.
Could we be looking at something like TiVo is to to digital TV or what have you? I mean, is this the same type of revolution that we're going to see, or what do you think? I mean, you're on the cusp of this.
Well, it depends on how bad the businessmen screw it up, in my opinion, to be very honest.
All right. Yeah,
that's right. Right now, people like Adam Curry and Dave Weiner, who have done some wonderful things. Adam Curry, we got to give him props for writing the first Apple script that made this podcasting happen. And Dave Weiner for helping to invent really simple syndication, which is what RSS stands for. But they have money symbols in their eyes, in my opinion. And if they hear this, I'm sorry, but I think what's going to happen because of that is that they're going to try to jump in with the big boys really quick. And the big boys, I mean by large broadcasting. And that's what's beautiful about what happened here with WXYC being a college radio station and doing the streaming themselves and taking upon themselves to do this innovation, is that they have taken away a lot of problems that can come about in the future when you start trying to deal with large amounts of money, lots of lawyers, lots of law. And I mean, I'm not proposing a complete anti-capitalist, you know, idea here, but I am saying that there needs to be patience and thoughtfulness about, you know, how we, you know, approach something. That's why all the audio I have is in a Creative Commons license that says you can share it, you can change it, but you need to get, you can't do it, use it commercially, but you need to give me credit, and that's all I'm asking. And I think that is embedded in the IDE3 tags, right, by the way, with MP3 to some extent. It's on the website. And it's creating this sharing environment that we can create a new structure around it that could be commercially viable. But we need to be careful. We need to have a little bit more power with this before you start going, trying to dance with NPR or CBS radio and saying, I want y'all to get involved in this. Come on. And then so they'll get involved in it and they go, okay, well, how do I track these downloads? How do I make sure somebody has it? How do I attach a, you know, payment system to this? And it's just going to be this big thing, just like streaming internet radio, and we're going to run into the same walls. Well, with my site, we're not going to run into those problems because I've already licensed it properly, and I said how I'm going to do that. So I'm bypassing ASCAP and BMG as far as I know. And as long as I don't broadcast, quote unquote, or podcast anything that is, I don't have permission for, and it's not under proper license, I should be, you know, in the clear.
Right, now, guys, what's going to stop me from playing, you know, my CD collection in my outdoor room, and then broadcasting this online, and I have maybe 15 to 20 people that I'm sending this out? Is there a danger of me getting charged with something?
Theoretically.
Now, Paul's shaking his head at me, and I don't want to be walking out with cuffs.
Yes, yeah, theoretically. Technically, there's nothing stopping you
from using. You should obey the law and respect property rights.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, I mean, that's the cool thing to do to artists, and I'm not saying that people should steal things from creative people. I'm a creative person, and I think it's wrong, but I think it's also, like you were talking earlier about not understanding certain types of technology and trying to take old paradigms, radio, TV, to new paradigms, internet stuff. Just like there are different paradigms of technology, there are different paradigms with, you know, the law and rights and what creative people want, and then we need a commons of ideas to share back and forth. Now, if we use the example of streaming radio as an example of how the future could happen, you know, with new technologies, and we take that as a map, yes, you may be sued in 10 years by some extremely wealthy, you know, RIAA lawyer dogs that want to go, you know, sue kids who are downloading music, yes. But I think that we've learned from that. We can learn from our mistakes and use licenses in your own work and create a body of work that's under a license that says, please share this, promote me. For example, the Wired CD, with probably Paul could probably talk
have
about
it,
a lot better.
Or the Creative Commons Act, which I don't know much about. Can you maybe?
Yeah, Paul could probably talk about Creative Commons
help
a lot
me out
better than I can.
Well, there's the turn it, I guess. I don't know whether we're coming through or not.
Okay.
Creative Commons is a group that was founded by Larry Lessig, who's now at Stanford, James Boyle, who's at Duke, and others. The idea is to, because as of 76, let's see if I can do the short part. It used to be in ancient days that
you knew whether something was copyright or not. You knew whether it was okay to use it because it had a little copyright symbol on it. However, beginning in 1976, anything at the instant of creation became the instant it was fixed. Copyright covers a fixed expression of an idea. So the instant that something is fixed, it becomes copyright. You don't even have to register it. So that means when you find something, a napkin scribbling or something else, you don't know whether it's okay to use it or not, because in theory, it's copyright. So everything suddenly was protected. The Commons advocates for a way to allow people to share. So working within the copyright law, it allows you to issue licenses to other people to permit them to do other things with your work, with your permission. And it doesn't replace copyright law, but it works within that law. Okay, so as Brian talked about, you can make it public domain, which means you give up all rights and just cancel the copyright law. I mean, and that actually turns out to be a kind of tough thing. Glenn Brown, who's the director of the Creative Commons, called up the Copyright Office and said, I have something I'd like to make public domain. How do I do it? And they said, we don't know about that. We know how to copyright things. We really don't know how to, like, make them free. And there is a license in which you say, basically, I give up all rights. Then there are three other licenses. You can be non-commercial, non-commercial reuse. You can use, and you can say whether people can make derivative works or not. That means whether they can take parts of it out or do something like that. And then there's attribution required. It turns out that everybody in the 2.5 years of the Creative Commons license existing chose attribution required. Everybody wants their name on what they've created, and they want that to follow through, even if they want nothing else. Commons works in that way. A second set of licenses were created for musicians because they have a more complicated law to work with. And to celebrate the creation of their sampling and sampling plus licenses, which David McConville was involved in helping develop, as was Mark Hostler of Negative Land, Creative Commons and Wired put together a concert with David Byrne and Gilberto Gil. Gil is the culture minister for Brazil. And
wow.
They're
very interesting cat, which you were telling me about.
Yeah, he's a total reggae wild man. He doesn't have Chuck Berry Feels Forever on here, which is one of my favorite ones. But the CD is free with Wired, but you can also give it to anybody else. It not only is it free to copy and reuse and hand to other people, but people are allowed to make new music from it, because creative people need access to cultural materials to make new work. And so, am I doing right so far?
Yeah, absolutely. You can get beats from the Beastie Boys.
Yeah, you can
sample
get
them all day long.
That's right. Sample the Beastie Boys. Sample David Byrne. Sample Zap Mama. Sample Danger Mouse.
I think something interesting too is only three of the artists said you cannot make money from this. The other ones said sample, make new songs, make money. Great.
That was actually the biggest thing on the list when we were talking about the sampling license. Was going back and forth about, like, you know, what do you do when Miller Genuine Draft wants to take your stuff and use it to sell stuff? And that was like, and that had actually happened in Negative Land. They'd approached them about doing an ad campaign. They were like, no way.
Well, that's why I chose the license I did.
Yeah. There are a lot of, that's the biggest problem in music and others, is that your work might be misappropriated in some ways. People are terrified about either, the Republican Party is going to use Bruce Springsteen, Nike is, or somebody's going to use your thing, or the White Patriots Party is going to use your beat.
The White Album.
Paul, that sort of leads to, if you look at what happened with, and it's a very similar legal path that occurred with Linux and the GPL.
Yeah, exactly. The model on this, when we had Larry come visit UNC, he and I spent several hours in the coffee shop with whoever would drop by, talking about why the GPL was important.
And
this
if everybody,
is Larry Lessig, right?
Yeah. Okay.
And if anybody doesn't know, the GPL General Programming License was just that. If you took any code that was put into that domain, you could not charge for anything.
for that code, but you could pass it in and you could use it free of charge. And they also could do the same thing for music and other media, is that if they go back and use it for charging, then they're going against the license.
That's right, and the license is revoked.
And the license is revoked, and you can then have a legal recourse to them because they use it outside your domain. But you still propagate having that artistry out into the...
Right, it's modeled very much on the code sharing.
Right.
Okay. Guys, Brian talks about patience and thought before we attack, before we attack new products or services. Are we too freaked out about products, new products and services coming online? Are we strangling, innovation with law and...
Well, I think the one place that it comes about, if you want to see some of the key, some of the places, anytime you attack anybody's revenue stream, you're going to get a counterattack. It's just a natural thing that happens in business. And one of the key areas that everybody I think is starting to be attuned to is the telephony, the telephone system you have now, where you can do a telephone call on the internet, any place in the world, and if you have the right device on both sides, you pay nothing. And what occurs is you're now attacking sacred cows for government, sacred cows for industry. And the telecom industry has made millions and billions, and actually more than that, probably close to trillions, on charging you for something where the technology was developed 40 years ago. But what happened is you've attacked a revenue stream. The same thing, I think, is for the music.
Certainly, the same exact thing.
And what happened is the artists in the music industry are coming to the same thing. They're saying is, we're not, most of the artists, it's like the people that are playing college basketball, right? How many of those college basketball players become pros and get $10 million contracts? Maybe one in 1,000, even maybe less than that.
Rare.
And so the same thing happens with the artists. How many of those actually get out there and are getting the revenue back?
Actually, 5% of the Billboard 100 make money.
And so, and even the ones that have been out their way that have been sort of hoodwinked by some of their agents and their other record companies and not getting the money off of those things. So it's, how do you now put fairness back into this? At the same time, you have these large industries that you're attacking the revenue stream. And it's something that I think there was a guy by the name of Christensen that came out with a book on disruptive technologies.
Yeah, you're talking, his is called, oh my gosh, I've got it sitting in my office right now. I had it at the tip of my tongue.
And the book really goes about is that if you come up with something new and it's innovative...
The subtitle is Why Great Corporations Fail.
Right. And it's
Innovator's Dilemma.
And it's Christensen, right?
Innovator's Dilemma by Christensen.
Right.
Okay, what is it? I mean, I guess...
And so what happens is, like the telephony, what happened is that they came up with a great idea, but you're changing what was normally a cash cow for someone, and now that industry, even if they understand that technology, they know it intimately and can do it, they will prevent it from going into the market because it's going to attack their revenue stream, which they don't have to put anything more into anymore. So what you'll have is various industries will actually stall or actually subterfuge. You know, it's some of the, myth and urban legends about the car that runs for 500 miles on a tank of gas or something like that. I'm sure that there's places out there that innovation and technology was prevented from going public because you disturbed the revenue stream of one of the industries. And that's a disruptive technology because even though I can invent it, I'm now cannot charge you $10 for that. I can only charge you 2 cents because that's what it is on the open market. Mm-hmm. And so those disruptive technologies, they try to manage those and then release innovation in a controlled sense. Governments get involved and you get the regulations.
Right. And this was this was before, that was a big part of the research that I was doing prior to this was looking at the DAT tax when digital audio tapes came out.
Oh, right.
They legislated that the hardware, you had a pro level and you had a consumer level, and you couldn't make perfect copies from the consumer level, and then they were taxing all the tapes just because they were in bed with the, I guess it was the RIAA at the time.
Yeah.
Saying that, unless you're a professional, then you're obviously going to be pirating, so you're, guilty until proven innocent, and so you're going to pay us this money to feed into the coffers of the music industry. Well, when you start doing all this with, 16-year-old software hackers in Norway that are figuring out how to crack DVDs, it gets a little bit less controllable, where you've got all the software innovation going on, and you've got these incredible tools being developed, and you don't really have the top-down control that you had at one point to kind of say, oh, whoa, this technology's coming along too fast, let's really put the brakes on it. Now it's like all this stuff comes out all the time, because you've got people in their bedrooms with, supercomputers on their desks that can come up with this.
You have your own radio station with WPVM.
Yeah.
.org. So if you're Asheville listeners, you can check in. 89.3. But now...
It's good. 103.5. Yeah, 89.3 is here.
Okay. Now, you've expanded a lot of listeners' listening taste. Do you think that the record industry will ever get that? I mean, the fact that, you know, people's listening tastes and cultures are expanding, and or is that something, hey, they're more concerned with what John was saying, hey, as long as the revenue stream
Well, don't you think, I mean, like, this has been the debate with Napster this whole time. I mean, like, I've had this conversation with, I don't know if the court, if, like,
it's not, I don't think that's finally decided.
Yeah, has
but
it
I
ever been decided whether if you get a lot of MP3s, you buy more CDs? Or I've seen that happen
well,
all the time.
Well, actually, the research done here by Coleman Strumpf and company shows that there's a zero effect.
Yeah, right.
And Coleman.
Was that here or two? That
yeah,
was like
it's
King
here.
Bradley,
here and here at Harvard.
But you know, Paul, I go back.
His is the largest empirical data ever used on that, and the most open. Okay. All of others are telephone interviews. Like, do you download illegal MP3s and did you buy a record? Well, I mean, what happened is nobody. Coleman also studies illegal behavior, just by the way. And the worst way to find out if anybody's doing illegal behavior is to call them up and ask them. I mean, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure this out. You know, the Pew study on the Internet and American Life says less people report downloading illegal music. Well, I guess the hell they do, because it's illegal. So why would they tell you that?
But Paul, you know, one of the things that go back to it in the discussion on legality or non-legality is just think back in time when even you had tape to tape, reel to reel.
Right.
How many people were taping records onto reel to reel, passing the tapes along, and not paying any copyright? And what happened now is when the technology becomes so visible that it starts addressing revenue streams, you can still use the internet, whether it's a podcast or something else. If you keep the family of people that are doing sharing, that it's not distributed, and they don't have any way of knowing about it, you can have tons of things happening out there.
See, I would never advocate breaking the law in that way, since I'm a responsible state employee.
Okay. Well, now, how do you think this... Now, guys, you guys are the experts, and I'll even throw this out to the crowd as well. How do you guys think listening patterns will change with podcasting and people posting on their DJ sets up on
I can only hope it'll help. I mean, I grew up in a period where there was regional broadcasting and where you could hear local bands on the radio, believe it or not, you know, and it wasn't just the college station. And in where you heard regional bands on the radio and where if you could pick up a New York station, you heard different music than if you picked up a Chicago station. And now you have Clear Channel. So basically, you know, everybody's got the same flavor of Wheaties. So, or your Fruit Loops are all one flavor or something. It's not very good. It's not very good for musicians. It's not very good, I think, for the music industry, and it's not very good for listeners. And I don't know how you stop that. I mean, it's like Walmart in some ways, you know. You go in and you get it, and it's cheap, and it's reliable, and people love Walmart. But there is a cost, a creative cost and a social cost for that kind of homogenization. The hope is that the internet will pick that up, but the internet is carrying an awful lot of weight truck here. I mean, it's going to save journalism, it's going to be alternative voices, it's going to save music, it's going to, you know, get me a date, it's going to get me a Rolex watch, it's going to make me a lot of money out of Nigeria. So I don't think it's going to do all
well,
this.
Don't be scared. So don't be scared. That's the message. All right.
No, man, don't be too euphoric.
Okay, don't be. All right. Well, we're going to switch the tapes here, so we're going to take a little short break. And we're going to switch the tapes and move back on.
Cool.
All right, guys. We got about 21 minutes. How about that? I'm almost down to the 30 seconds here, but I got a quick question from the crowd.
I wanted to answer your last question about how this is changing the way we listen to radio and things
okay.
like that.
Okay.
You know, as of when, I remember when XYZ started streaming, and I've always had the type of job that I was usually at a computer and online at whatever job I was doing. So the advent of internet radio allowed me to have a much wider range of things that I listen to and choices around the world, which never stopped me from listening to XYZ, by the way. But that would only happen when you're at your computer. But this has been something that we've discussed on another interesting local website, orangepolitics.org, where we're discussing, I couldn't help it, but we're discussing WUNC, which is our local big corporate NPR station, and whether we have a choice about whether we listen to them or not, if we don't like their underwriting and things like that. And I'm not limited anymore to only listening to internet radio when I'm at a computer, because I have a handheld device that can take streaming radio. And what I do now is when I go out for a jog, I'm listening to NPR on here, and I'm usually listening to it on WAMU out of Washington, D.C., because I like that station. And so I have really no need to listen to WUNC locally if I want NPR, unless they offer me something more of value. And so, you know, so my advice to them in this particular case is, you know, I would like to have more local information. That would make me listen to them instead of to a station in another city. So that's a real demand for them to do something that both information that's locally relevant and perspectives that are locally relevant. And since we live in a progressive community, I expect them to reflect those values of our community too. And XYC has filled in a niche musically, you know, as people have known, you know, winning awards over 10 years ago for unique programming. And I know that when they went online, people around the world were thrilled to get access to that. So I think that's one of the big implications of the many more choices we have.
Just to say something about the the localism issue to me is huge. I mean, since I left Sunsight and went back to Asheville, I've been working on a lot of issues with cable franchises and public access television stations and off-air broadcasting stations, and it's just the more and more that media has been consolidated, the less and less you actually see local coverage, especially on off-air and cable media outlets. And it's incredibly, there's a huge gap between the amount of interesting innovation that's going on the internet and then what's actually happening with radio and television. I mean, and my hope is that with a lot of what's happening with internet too, and the different convergences that will be going on, we'll see that the type of innovation that's applied online to start to bleed over into what's happening with community radio stations, what's happening with community-run television stations. Like when people can finally get access to easy nonlinear video editing tools, and you can make better and better quality work, so it doesn't look like it was produced at a, you know, the stereotypical public access show. I mean, there's a lot of that type of innovation that I'm really happy to see with the software advances and everything else, that allows people to start doing better and better and more professional-looking media so that we can start focusing on local issues. Because as Clear Channel, I mean, what is it? Like, we put this low-power FM station on air, which is almost all progressive politics and a lot of free-form music. But then shortly thereafter, like a couple months ago, Clear Channel came in with an AM station that's mm-hmm. the Air America stuff, right? And it's kind of a cognitive dissonant thing for me because it's, you know, kind of shock jock leftists in Walmart ads, and then all their news is from the Hudson Valley in New York, and I'm like, you know, what does this have to do with localism? It's really strange. And so I'm hoping that a lot of, you know, the approaches that people are taking and the care that they're taking with their online efforts will really start to be applied on a local level, because that's the most crucial thing, especially in our democracy, is that people know or are informed about what's going on in their own communities. And the more it's globalized, and I mean, it's ironic because you're talking about listening to the station out of D.C. and you really like that, but at the same time, it can also really help to pump the, you know, media on the local level.
But there's a lot of DJs out in the community right now and listening to our station, you, like you said about listening to the DC station being, you know, via your PDA. What are some ways that you differentiate your station so you can promote local activities and localism and community activism through your station? What are some things that maybe XYC you think can take from that?
I mean, I'm not involved with the station directly anymore because I kind of wanted to get it technically started up. And what I did was try to make sure that the best people possible were involved and got as many local DJs involved and as many people that actually cared about news and events in the area. I think XYC does a great job. I mean, I don't know. I've never had a complaint about it. I listen to it all the time online. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, it's, I don't know. I don't have any advice for XYC.
Okay. Yeah.
But I'll go back to the what was the comment there. I think that if you look at what has happened commercially on cable, there's something that has led just to your point. If you look at depending on the cable channel, there's cable channel 14. And what it is, it's 24-hour news, and why it's gone so well, and it's also a lot, as a matter of fact, almost predominantly local information. It's local information, 24 hours, and there's almost no, but not totally none, advertisement. So if you want news, if I went through it just one time, and I clocked through one of the, whatever you want to, REL, WTV, Channel 11, or any of the ones, of the hour of news that was presented, 15 minutes was real news of anything else, and all the rest was commercials. So at that point in time, there's a natural thing for TiVo, or if you want to do podcasts or something else. But at the same point, if I go into my office, And I get in relatively early into my office just to beat the traffic, not because I really want to go in early. But so if I get in relatively early, I tune into NPR in Los Angeles because it's up, it's doing the news. And I don't care about that, but you're right, I can get that local information because it's easy. And now I can also bring up WUNC as well, but it was just as easy on the pod to be able to go through and get that. That's where I do it. So I agree 100% with you that the local aspect of it is why people are going to go to more of these smaller stations, because the commercialization is taking what the information you really want to know, what's happened locally.
Sinclair,
is there a business model that's going to support this?
Actually, there is a there's an AM station in Chapel Hill that does all local.
Repeat the question.
The question is there a business model to support this localization?
The reason I'm asking is because
I think that's a good question.
Would be for this to kind of, once this sort of localism gets going, what'll happen is what'll happen with blogs. First there was one, then there's a gazillion. Which one to listen to, and how does it get paid for?
Okay, so the question is, how is there a business model for, say, a local community radio station that I could broadcast via podcast or...
Well, I think there are two ways that it's done. I mean, one is low-power FM that David's talked about and that we have in Carrboro with WCOM. And then, through some miracle that I don't completely understand, Jim Hefner, who had WCHL forever and was a DJ there as a student, bought it back... from Don Curtis, who had basically made it into a remote control station with no live human beings, and turned it into constant talk radio in which the interviewers are people from the town. And if you can go and propose a show to them. I mean, in fact, he's asked people here to run shows, and most of us were too sane to do this. But not music, but it's interview shows, and he interviews, you know, they cover everybody at town council forums running for town council, every forum of county commissioners.
So is it
ad supported. It's ad supported. It's regular AM radio with Air America, their own drive-in DJs doing local news with some CBS News support. But it's like old FM radio without music. I mean, but... You know, you turn on and they're interviewing somebody down the street who's done something interesting, or they're interviewing a local politician, or usually for longer than we should be talked to. I mean, I've done a few shows with them, so.
And even the ads are local.
Yeah, I mean, it's
there
very.
There are a lot of ads on CHL, but they are local. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's corny in the ways that drive my wife, who came from a small town in Texas, and that's all she could get, nuts, but that I love. Because to me, it's, you know, I grew up in Charlotte, and the wackier, edgier music where you got it came onto those guys who were self-producing the ads, who, you know, had these little hick voices that would come in and say, "Oh, Jim, I've been out on the porch drinking a beer. What kind of beer are you drinking?" "Oh, I've been drinking Budweiser. It's on sale this week at Food Line." I think those are wonderful artistic moments in my own sick way.
Now, Paul, here's the thing. I've just been amazed by the explosion of blogs last year. Okay, now, what would stop, say, an Al Franken from New York City, or, say, anybody in this audience, or somebody in Carrboro that wanted to start off a podcast and own talk show, get their own thing? Is there, if they did that...
It's all about quality and listeners. I mean, you can do that.
For accessibility, is there any way that they could get in trouble or anything like that? Or is there any legalities that would come back on them? What can they do to safeguard themselves?
You have all the regular problems of journalism. I mean, you can't be libelous or slanderous. You know, you can't do those kind of things. You can't do those at Ruby's thing, and you can't do those at Brian's thing. I mean, people will try. I mean, you have responsibilities when you do this kind of stuff. I mean, that's important. But, you have to have listeners before you even count, really, or readers, and that really matters to somewhat. You're probably asking because I walked in with Dan Gilmore's book called We the Media, which is all about what he calls grassroots journalism. It's about blogging, and he wrote this book with a blog that people could reply and correct his chapters and add to them and otherwise drive him completely nuts. And he cites all that. He's been a technology reporter for the Mercury News in San Jose for a long time, through all the boom and everything else. He's a well-respected guy. And so he writes about Wiener and about syndication. And part of the big deal in blogs is not just that you're writing and you have the stuff there yourself. There are two or three ways you can correlate that a blog is successful. One is if a lot of people are picking up your RSS, if a lot of people are looking at your blogs and you look at the stats, people are reading it, that always makes you feel good, even if it's your boyfriend or girlfriend in the other room hitting reload button all the time, so you won't be depressed. How many people are subscribing to the RSS feed? You want to know, you know, that kind of thing. And the third one that Fred Stutman's pointed to me about the real social capital in blogs is whether you have really good comments on your postings. And I think that's really true. You know, is if you have high quality postings, and then you're a pretty successful blog. And the most successful ones will just say, here's an open thread on blah. And, you know, the author isn't doing anything. But exploiting the social capital they built up by having done good things and good things there. So you can pretty much tell.
Well, hey, the listeners, you can get out there and build your own.
No, that's
so,
right.
This is something that's capable, you're able to do.
I just want to say real quick that I think as far as blogging and your fear of the legal thing, I'm not a lawyer, but I think there's a area of safety, and that area of safety is before you start having enough listeners until you threaten someone else's business model. So as long as like you have 1,000, 5,000 people, you know, or 500 or 50, you know, and you can really serve them really well and get a lot of satisfaction from serving them well, then I think you're going to be most of the time pretty in the clear until, let's say, something with podcasting, which I think is coming along, is there a bunch of people joining on, and then it creates enough buzz that it gets enough attention, then you start people saying, okay, how can I squash that as part of my planned obsolescence plan and my business model, you know? But I think there's a lot of safety in doing these things and making a living in some way, so.
Well, no, seriously, tell people about your site. Do you have directions on how to set one up? Where can people go to set one up?
No, I think the best place to go to learn about that is probably iBiblio.org's front page right now, because there are links to that. There's also wikipedia.org/podcasting, which is like becoming like the most incredible.
Wikipedia,
it's a public dictionary that people join in with a wiki, which is a type of blog, really, that people come on and say, I know what the definition is of that because I'm an expert, and they can add it, and then people check it. It's peer review kind of checking. But anyways, that place right now has a really great definition of podcasting. It has links to all the how-tos, links to the directories to find out where the stuff is. That's where people are, you know, you have lots of blogs, and how do you know what the hell is a cool one? You could use something, an aggregator called Blog Lines, and look at other people's links, because as Paul could probably talk about, you take your advice from your friends. You're not taking your advice from the big media maven or from, you know, an advertisement necessarily. You're listening to your friends. That's who you really trust. So,
well, you know, one of the things I'd like to add to what was just said, and back to what Paul made a couple of comments before, is if you don't, and I just do this when I'm doing just general things, if it's not illegal, immoral, or fits in that venue, then if you're going to do, when you're in, even in the startup, the new things, you have less chance of getting into where you get squashed later on. Because it may have to change precedent law to allow it to happen, but they're going to try to use an old regulation upon you at some point in time, but you'll have the right moral stance to go forward with. If you use this as an instrument just to bypass current laws and copyright, then eventually you will get squashed, because what happens, you will attack their revenue stream. And if you're in the wrong category, as Paul said, that's, you know, it's not illegal and immoral, then you'll be okay. But if it is, then you got trouble. So if you're thinking that this is a way to get around it, well, as soon as it has enough visibility, then you will be in the limelight.
So act with integrity and you shall pass.
I think it's a good suggestion. I just want to say that my venture is not commercial at all. And I don't ever plan it for it to be commercial. You know, it is individual, you know, expression of my creativity. And that, you know, I just made those suggestions to people who do think about starting something and having it pay for itself. I mean, that's the first big step, is like, I'm not paying hosting costs. You know, I'm paying a little bit of my own time and those kind of things. And that's what most people really want to do, because their real payment is going to be in good comments. It's going to be in making people happy. I mean, that's why people are, I mean, you know, idealistically make things, right? Is for others and to enjoy their happiness. But, you know, I just have to make that statement to say that I'm not commercially motivated in what I'm doing. But I think a lot about the law, because as an artist, I'm really concerned about other artists' intellectual property.
Okay. Well, Brian, hey, you came through big time with the mics today.
Yeah, that's my pleasure.
I'm glad I could.
I believe you. Check people can check out your site at
audioactivism.org.
Okay, that's one word, audioactivism.
Yep.
All right. And then John, thanks a ton.
Yep.
Appreciate it. And then David, all the way down from Asheville, they can check out, I guess you could say, a listener-supported radio station in Asheville, which is?
WPVM 103.5.
And also check out the Illuminati.
No, don't.
No?
They'll check you out. They'll check you out. If
no.
Okay.
Well, I'm not going to tell you how to spell it.
All right. But you're doing some very interesting stuff. I'm going to keep my eye out for
okay.
you.
Okay. Thanks.
And then, Mike, hey, thanks a ton. Hope to see you around campus. You're the technologist, and seriously, thank you for being a cheerleader and catalyst.
I'm quite a cheerleader.
Yeah. Everybody else. Yeah.
One thing about this that
epileptic when it but
that's not good. One thing about this that just I guess we're summing up some stuff. All this one thing that's interesting to me to watch is it looks to me like now we have, you know, there's sort of a democratization or a whatever. Things have become cheap. It's easy to put stuff up. You know, there's a lot of tools available. There's a lot of open source free things. You can do whatever. So there's a lot more variety out there, whereas, you know, even 7 years ago or 10 years ago, there was very little, and we're in the middle of a very consolidated sort of media, which still exists. What's interesting to me will be see what people do, what consumers do, because in theory, you can listen to whatever you want. You can listen to Burmese music, you can listen to stations in Japan, you can, you know, just in the, on the simulcast aspects of things, but it'll be interesting to see what actually happens over the coming 10 or 20 years and how much that actually plays out and how much, you know, sometimes people just want to listen to the Consensus 400 or whatever it's called, and that's what'll keep Clear Channel in the black. And on the other hand, maybe they'll listen to...
I want to add on to that, just because I think that, especially with electronic media communications, it's the literacy of this century. And not a lot of attention is being paid to teaching people how to use these tools. I mean, people are doing it out of the love of it for the most part, but in terms of media literacy, in terms of actually educating kids about this saturated environment that we're in, I think it's a really crucial thing that people have to, it's kind of DIY a lot of times because it's not something that's mandated in schools, but it's crucial, especially with kids, to start getting them thinking about all of these messages that are being right. honed and tailored and shot at them all the time to basically control their desires. And you know, and that's kind of what this is all about. It's control of your own destiny and being able to actually create your own reality instead of having somebody else create it for you. With that, I'm going to give another plug for another nonprofit that I run called the Media Arts Project.
Which
that's
is?
themap.org.
Okay.
Themap.org. It's just there's a lot of media arts organizations around the country now that are starting to focus on this stuff, really pushing localism in media, really trying to get, you know, kids actively engaged in media.
In public schools.
In public schools especially. I don't know how successful it is in public schools, but...
Every step is hurt. You
know? Yeah, yeah. But I mean, but that's what's so cool about the technology is that it is cheap now. I mean, and it's becoming more and more viable for people to actually understand, you know, the nature of the edit and what that does to the world that we live in.
Okay, and then one point from Tim Ross.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up, like, sort of what both David and Mike are talking about. Like Mike said, it'd be really interesting to see what consumers do and, like, what they decide to start consuming. But it's also going to be interesting to see what, like, sort of the old content providers start to do, like, mm-hmm. will a station like XYC at some point find it cost prohibitive to have a $30,000 transmitter when we could reach more people online? That's not the case now, but will that happen at some point? And like, when will people start jumping?
Yeah, that's possible with iTunes. We were talking about that over our email list the last week.
When you get internet-enabled radios and cars, then you'll see
satellite radio. WCPE is a very good example of this, the classical station, which we also broadcast and which you're also doing IPv6 with. WCPE is a small classical station broadcast out of Wake Forest, North Carolina. Most of their fundraising comes from the internet. Mm-hmm. That's where their listeners really are. And that was a decision that Deborah Proctor made early on, that if her station was going to really make a difference and really get out there, that wasn't going to be just by increasing their transmitter, which of course would cause them to interfere with WXYC, but it would be to push alternative things. And there, if you go to classical in your iTunes, they're under there, streamed by us. already. You know, they're registered there. They've done a lot to get their name out there. They've been about a lot to be the lead. They've been very aggressive in the copyright negotiations with the copyright office. In fact, Jesse Helms came and stepped in and lobbied for them, and WXYC benefited from that. So there are stations that have taken that advantage. KPIG did it and backed off, but CPE has really, really taken off, and that's where their income comes from. I mean, that's where their listeners, when they do fundraising, they're fundraising on the internet.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, hopefully we stay focused. You want to make one last point?
One short time. Is that, to get back to your point, is if you can look at the technology as it's changing and change your paradigm that says maybe you don't have to have a transmitter anymore, maybe you can use another way of whether you stream it, you know, with a podcast or whatever, then you can do it where you've leveled the capital cost that of entry, and now you can go this alternate fashion. That's the way that technology you're going to use for you, because if you have to do battle with a large corporation where a 100 megawatt transmitter may cost you $50 million, $100 million, don't do that battle. You can do the battle at WUNC and get the fundraising in there, but if you want to do it another way and keep the creativity, use technology smart. That's the way to go.
Okay. I think we've touched on a lot about the future of the mass audience, and so even though the mass audience is fragmented, there's a lot of media research that shows it's not going to go away, and there's several reasons why not. You know, political economy is one, and also the psychology. You want to talk about who's listening to whatever.
Okay, well, hopefully we have a commitment from students. Hey, if you want to get involved with WXYC, always feel free to stop by the station. We need technology. We need to make a major boost in the commitment in technology around the community. Push it up. Special thanks to Tim Ross. You wrote an excellent article in Inaudible. Check that newsletter out. And hey, I also have to say thank you for coming to the godfather of technology. You will be. Seriously, at UNC Chapel Hill, Paul Jones, thanks a ton.
I feel good.
Okay. All right. Well, hey. Thank you also to Fred Stutzman for being able to record this. And also, I'm Brett Doherty. Check in at Sports Wrap at 9 o'clock. I'll be back on the air. Okay, thanks, people. All right.